Today, what I want to do is to introduce a microscopic, so an atomic system that we can control as a small quantum processor. And the one I'm going to introduce, the Diamond NV system, has the advantage that it's coherent enough to do things with at room temperature. And so, you could say, well, why do we want a room temperature quantum system? And we would like those so that we could make gyroscopes, we could make magnetic sensors, we could make chemical sensors, and as building blocks for quantum repeaters and for perhaps small quantum nodes of a processor. So the idea then is to have this small system, Diamond NV. And for most of those applications, we just need a quantum state. But for some of them, if we're going to make a sensor for chemistry, for instance, then we need to bring the chemistry close to the system. And so for some of it, it's going to be important that we can get close to it. For others, it's not important that we can get close. It's just that the system is coherent and easy to take out to the lab. And of course, NVs are not the only system. There's a really nice examples of trapped ions where you can have a chip with your trapped ion and walk around with it, as long as you're careful how you walk. The NV, the examples I choose, typically I'm going to use ones where we don't have to add quantum degrees of freedom that have infinite dimension, just to keep things smaller. Okay, so what do we need? We need, from this, we're going to need easy state preparation, of course. We want good readouts. We want to be able to manipulate. And the last thing I want is a modest-sized Hilbert space. And we should keep in mind that we don't know how to build a quantum computer. Anyone that tells you they do is full of it. Okay? And so, as we try to build a quantum computer, there's this beautiful paper that I hope you've seen, titled "More is Different." Okay, and the idea is that as you build complexity into a system, you're going to see different structures in it. So as we build complexity to try to make a quantum computer, then the things that work for 2 qubits are not going to trivially work for more qubits. And one of the challenges of a quantum computer is, all the challenges actually of a quantum computer is the scaling. And so, we need to do things in parallel, we need to do measurements, and perhaps one of the ways of getting there is to imagine that we would have nodes of small processors that were interconnected in some way, so that for some of the day we can be worrying about the node itself and maybe have things easier. We don't know if that's the right way to do things either, but we could imagine the Diamond NV is also one of these nodes. Okay, so we'll see where the spins come in. Now, so it's a diamond, and that's the unit cell of a diamond. So a diamond, of course, is just carbon atoms bonded together tetrahedrally, and it has its beautiful properties, one, because it is just carbon, so it's a big band gap. And two, that everything is covalent. So we have, although this is a unit cell, you know, there's another bond coming out of here. Everything's tetrahedral. Let me not draw them all. It'll get to be a mess. And the what we do is we remove two carbons. And we replace one carbon with a nitrogen. And so a nitrogen, instead of having four bonds, has three bonds. And it has a lone pair of electrons. And then we have a vacancy. So just a missing atom there. And so if we counted up the electrons, for the missing atom, we have three electrons, the three bonds that should have been to it. Of course, there's four bonds to it, but one of those would be this nitrogen. So we have three electrons here. We have two electrons here. But the NV is a charge center. It's an NV minus. Okay, so there's six total electrons. And those six electrons, we don't know in detail what the electronic state is. There is a bunch of theory, but it's complicated and it's not been worked out experimentally completely. But what we do know is that it looks like a spin one electron. Now, of course, you've been told all your career that electrons are spin one half. And so what we get now is an effective electron that's going to look like a spin one. And so we want to have a look at what that is. Now, the diamond is going to be very, very clean. So we're going to grow our diamond in a high vacuum system that is a chemical vapor deposition system, so that we can keep all of the defects out. And then we'll carefully add nitrogen at the end, usually by ion implantation. And at the beginning of the field, in order to get the diamond, you would have to find some natural diamond. And so the early papers talk about the magic diamond, which was the only diamond that had some coherence. And then there was a diamond that had even better coherence, which was the magic diamond. And everyone would use the magic diamond. But now you can have commercially available diamonds that give you that. Okay. So now six electrons is too much to work with. And we don't need it because we're only going to talk about a spin one system. So what we're going to imagine is that we have two electrons. And that they are indistinguishable and exchange coupled. Okay, so we have two electrons. And if I write down the Hamiltonian, so I have one term, which would be the distinguishability between these two. And in fact, what we're going to do for now is take that to zero so that they're really not distinguishable. I have another piece that says that these that the spin states of the electrons can be exchanged. So I can go from up, down to down, up, and vice versa, and that will be energy conserving. And then I have a term that says basically that the two electrons see each other's spin state. Okay? And so if I take these and we look at the eigenstructure of this, what we'll find is that we'll have a degenerate set of two eigenstates that are the up, up, and down, down. There'll be a state which is the symmetric combination of up, down, and down, up. And of course, that's not surprising since this is switching those two. And then there'll be the anti-symmetric version of that, sitting off by itself. And this piece you've heard about before as the triplet manifold, and this as the singlet. Okay. And here, of course, what I've done is I've written this down as though we have the two spins. But we really do want to work in this space where we have one spin, one electron. And so then we'll describe these instead by their MZ quantum number. And so we'll have plus and minus 1, 0. And of course, here's the singlet, and let's call it S so that we don't have any confusion between the 0, MS equals 0, the triplet manifold, and MS equals 0, the singlet manifold. Yeah. It will be eventually, yeah. Now I'm going to show you that the singlet plays an important role, but for our control, we're going to live in the triplet manifold. Okay. So now that's the spin structure, and of course, the energies associated with the spin are small. And we'll see eventually that separation between the plus minus 1, 0 stage is about 3 gigahertz. But it's also important in the NV to look a little bit at the electronic structure. So the electronic structure is going to have a first excited state, and this energy is 632 nanometers, so that's red light. And since we didn't describe the ground state electronic structure, I'm not going to describe the excited state electronic structure, just to say experimentally this is what we see. Now we still have the spin structure. And the nice thing about the NV system is that these are cycling transitions. So if I excite with red light and I'm into zero, then I'll go back down to the zero and I'll get a photon off. And I can do that over and over and over again. Okay, so if I'm living in the zero state, I can turn on light and I can get as many photons out as I would like to see. And something similar, but not exactly the same, happens in the plus minus one state. Okay, so that's what we want to see for this piece. If we're in the plus minus one manifold, we have this singlet transition over here. And what will happen is that a third of the time, there'll be an inter-system crossing. It'll cross over from the plus or minus one into the singlet state. And then this will fall down and come back to zero state. And so I want to tell you a little bit about how that happens. So we're going to look at the dipole allowed transitions. And that means that the operator I want for a dipole allowed transition is the operator of the magnetic dipole, so sigma x. So in the two-spin space, this is the operator that I want to think about. And it doesn't distinguish between the two spins. So it has that nice structure. And the reason I'm going to write it in this two-spin space is I'm interested in the transition probability from the triplet to the singlet. So I couldn't, of course, write that in the spin one space. All right. So now, at this point, we only care if things are allowed or not. So all we need to do is to look at the inner product of two states with that dipole transition operator, what you would square if you were going to calculate Fermi's golden rule for a rate and divide by the difference in energy. Okay, but we'll just look at the inner product. And so if I look here and I look at the inner product of this with the ms equals zero state, this is, of course, not equal to zero because we'll have terms that survive that look like this and that look like that, so life is good. But clearly, if I was looking at the transition to the singlet state, this negative sign defeats us. And so, as we would expect, and the reason that we've labeled these singlets and triplets is that if the two electrons are distinguishable, then you can have transitions within the triplet manifold, but you can't have transitions within between the triplet and the singlet manifold. Okay. Now, I did my postdoc in Holland where at the time, everyone who wanted to get to advance in magnetic resonance had to spend some time in Holland. That was the source of everything. And I was working with Bieber and Bamon, and he had this nice story that the solid state is like Amsterdam. That if you were talking about an atomic system, then these selection rules really do hold. But if you're in the solid state, everything is allowed. And to show you that, what happens in the solid state is I have these two spins, these two electrons. They really are distinct electrons. And the solid state can differentiate those by having a small electric field gradient in the solid state or having some other spin. And so in the solid state, this is a little bit too restrictive. And so we say, well, okay, I'm in the solid state. So let's look at a slightly modified dipole operator. Now, of course, alpha and beta should be really close to one, but they're not going to be exactly one. And now then, let's look here. And clearly, you will see that if alpha and beta are not equal, then we'll end up with this term. Let me make sure that I get it right. Exactly right. Thank you. So if alpha is not equal to beta, then this is not equal to zero. So we're allowed to, so the what we would say is that the transition from plus one, and the same thing holds for minus one, to the singlet state is weakly allowed. Now, it's a trivial piece to show that if I take the transition, if I look at the transition probability from the MS equals zero state in the triplet manifold, to the MS equals zero state in the singlet manifold, that remains zero. So what happens in the solid state is that this transition becomes weakly allowed, but these transitions are still forbidden. Okay? Good. All right. So now then, let's redraw our energy level diagram. If I excite from zero, I'll come back to zero, I'll get a cycling transition, and the lifetime is about 20 nanoseconds. If I excite from plus or minus one, it will come down two-thirds of the time, one-third of the time, it will transition over into the singlet state. The lifetime is still about 20 nanoseconds. But the lifetime in the singlet state is 300 nanoseconds. And then from the singlet state, It falls down. And here, we don't know exactly the details, and there's a bunch of models out there. But a good model, and one that we're absolutely sure is not correct in all the details, is that it 100% of the time falls down into the zero state. Okay? So let's just take that as being the case. And this is called dark. That's not quite true. It gives off an infrared photon. But we never look. So we'll pretend it's dark. Okay? So what happens is, if I'm in the zero state, I stay in the zero state. If I'm in the plus or minus one state, I cycle back and forth a little bit, but then there's an inner system crossing, and I fall back down in the zero state. And so with the NV, we have a really simple way to prepare an initial state. Turn on the laser and look. Sorry, turn the laser and wait. And so if I turn on the laser and I look, if I'm in the zero state, then I'll stay in the zero state. If I'm in the one state, then I will slowly decay and the zero state will build up. And of course, there's a separation in time because I'm sitting over here in this dark state in between. Okay. Good. So that's a really good question. You say, how should we define T1 in this system, right? So here, when I turn the laser on, then I have a map. And it looks like I have a T1 process with a fixed point that's a pure zero state, okay? And the others are going to decay. And, you know, one could ask, can you write a correct map for that? And the answer is no. Because if I only describe a map over those three states, then I'm going to look like I've lost part of my system in between, and it'll come back. So if we wanted to write out the map for that correctly, we'd have to include the singlet state as well. And then you'd say, oh yeah, turn the light on. I have this T1 process, which is polarizing to the MS equals zero ground state in the singlet manifold, in the triplet manifold, sorry. And then you turn the laser off. And the system pretty much stays there. So that the T1 in the absence of a laser is going to have a different fixed point because this separation is only 3 gigahertz. So the thermal equilibrium state is quite mixed between these, right? But the time scale for that process is so long that we can forget about it. Now, okay, so we can polarize. The other thing we can do is we can detect which state we're in. So if I turn on the laser and I'm in the MS equals zero and I just integrate photons, so the intensity is equal to the integral of the photon, that I see times time. So intensity is number of photons times their energy, right? And I have time here. And of course, the laser's on. Then the zero state will do this. But the one state will start with a slope that's only two-thirds of the initial slope, right? Because a third of the time, it's not giving a photon. It starts with two-thirds. And then at some point, it's all in the zero state, and it will have the same rate. And of course, the figure of merit we want here is to say the difference in intensities between the zero and one manifolds divided by the noise, which is the square root of the total counts that we would have. And so it doesn't help you to count out here because you're just increasing the noise on your system and you're never increasing the difference in counts. And so as you have more and more noise, you lose. And so what you have to do is you need to integrate for a short window around here. To maximize the contrast that you would see in this case. Yeah? Okay, so we can detect. But notice that the detection is written down in terms of intensity. So it's, of course, you don't get an expectation value by measuring one photon. All right. Now, looking some more at our diamond system, so it helps to remember that a diamond is tetrahedral. And so that the NV axis could be pointed. So if I have a nitrogen here, then the vacancy could be at any four of those locations. So if I took my diamond and I just looked at the bulk diamond, then I would have four different experiments I was doing depending upon for that particular defect, what the orientation is of the NV. And then it gets a little bit worse because in diamond, so we get this orientation, four orientations. And then it gets a little bit worse because the diamond is made up of carbon and carbon 13 is spin 1/2 and has a natural abundance of 1%. And the hyperfine interaction, so the magnetic interaction between the electron spin and the carbon spin is 150 megahertz for the nearest carbon spin. And we'll talk about the hyperfine interaction later. But of course, if I was looking at a bulk diamond, then I would see different random places where the carbon was C13 local to the diamond defect. So we'd have some diamond defect, and for this diamond defect, this carbon might be a C13. And then, of course, if it's a C13, its state might be up or it could be down. Right, all of that's random. And then there'll be some other C13, and again, it will be up or down. And there's other defects in your system. There's other electrons that are there. And so at the end of the day, we want to find a way of looking at one defect at a time. And a recurring theme of this class is that our friends in Holland always do the hard work, and then we get the Nobel Prizes for it. Not me personally, of course, but in the Von der Waals lab in Holland, and if you don't know that, Von der Waals has a long, long tradition of that family doing excellent science and of being lead in this in science. But in there, in Von der Waals' lab, Jan Schmidt came and he looked with a near-field optics at anthracene, which is another defect that you can control. It's another atomic defect. And was able to map out the properties of that locally. And then Bill Moyer joined him from Stanford for a year. And Bill is the one who won the Nobel Prize for showing that you could do single spin optical NMR and some other very nice things that Bill did. So let's see what we're going to do here. So I'm going to take my laser and I'm going to excite one defect. Now, the laser, of course, is directed in space. And the defect, like every other defect that's not in a photonic cavity, is going to emit in all directions, right? It's just a point source. And so one could imagine that I'm going to sit over here with my detector. And I won't see the laser. But of course, the laser has lots of power. And this little defect, the most it can emit is one photon. And it's not going to emit the photon to you. It's going to emit the photon randomly. So the intensity here, well, that's zero. Fortunately, we're really good at seeing individual photons. So this doesn't work very well. So we need one more piece of physics. And the nice thing is that if I excite way up here, so I'm going to excite, with 532. And now I've made a mistake. Not that you'll care too much, I think. That's 637. I know. It's slacking off here. Okay, so we excite in the green. And this will very, very quickly fall down here. And even though we're exciting above the with energy above the electronic structure, and we don't know what the states are, it conserves the magnetic quantum number. That's not surprising. If it's going to have a fast transition, it would have a hard time learning what the magnetic quantum number was. So it's going to fall down, it'll keep the magnetic quantum number, and then it'll be a cycling transition. And the great thing there, of course, is because I now excite at a higher energy, I can separate the emitted light from the excited light with just a filter. And so that becomes very simple. And the same thing is true for the MS equals one manifolds, right? So that all works. Okay. So now then we just need a filter. Now we still have this challenge that we're going to look at a small optical spot size. So we're looking at red light. And so the focal spot is going to be something like a micron. And I want there to be one defect in 1 micron cubed. And that defect, of course, is one atom. And a micron cubed has about 10 to the 11 atoms. So we still need to get these magic type diamonds. Fortunately, we can grow them ourselves, but that's how it's going to be. So we do this all now with confocal microscopy. So what we do is we have a laser that's going to impinge on a pinhole. And a pinhole just gives us a focal spot. And instead of putting a lens there and focusing on a spot, we put the pinhole and define a focal spot. And then we'll have an actual lens. And we have our focal spot here. And we'll put that inside our diamond. And then I will put a mirror. So it's called a dichroic mirror. And the deal of the dichroic mirror is that for green light, it's transparent. And for red light, it's a mirror. So green light, the laser just goes through it. But the light coming back gets reflected, and we put another pinhole here to define the focal spot. So notice that by defining these focal spots at the pinhole, I define the focal spot over here. Okay. And then we put a detector here. And we use a APD, an avalanche photon, avalanche photodetector. And that can easily see one single photon. Your eye is a single photon detector. So if I took you and I set you alone or with a group in a room, dark room, for 4 or 5 hours, and then if I had a photon source that emitted just a single photon, then statistically you would be able to see that. The experiment was done just like that. It's a boring experiment for the detectors, but you have a single photon, not great sensitivity, but you can detect a single photon. Okay, so now we have this. Now, the reason we have the two pinholes is, of course, I need to line up the focal spot that I'm exciting and that I'm detecting from to be the same place. And so that's the challenge of getting these two in the right location. Then we can take our diamond and with stages, we can ramp it around so that we can choose, we can image and then sit on the spot once we find one. We can also, though I won't describe it, put a set of galvo mirrors here and ramp the beam in two directions. So I can do that as well. Okay. Now the next thing we need is, fine, I've got a spot. I've got the two spot sizes, the two focal spots aligned with each other. That's the con and the confocal. And then I want to show that I have one photon, right? I want to show, let's call it, I want to show that I have one NV defect. I'm going to use the fact that it can only emit one photon at a time. And the easiest way of doing this is an experiment which is often described quantum mechanically, but I don't know why. Basically, you say, if the system can only emit one photon, then if I look at some instant in time, I should only see one photon. And so we take our photon and we take it to a half-silvered mirror, so a beam splitter, and to two detectors. And in one of those detectors, I include a variable delay. And we have some electronics, which is called a coincidence detector. And all it does is it says, if it sees in a small window a signal from both of these detectors, then it clicks. Otherwise, it doesn't. And if I look at the number of coincidences versus delta T, then if it's a single photon detector, then when I've correctly aligned those two times, then the photon has to go to one detector or not. There's only one photon, it can't hit both detectors. And all we do is scan this. Of course, if DT is not set up so that the photon, now you want it, what you're setting this to for the dip is that if a photon went this path or a photon went this path, that it would fire the detector at exactly the same instant. Instead, if this one is misset, then although we're looking for coincidences, we're looking for coincidences of events separated in time. And of course, there's no problem with the single photon emitter emitting a photon here and emitting a photon at a time later. Okay, so it's only when those two paths, those two times become exactly the same, that we have this dip. Okay, so we can do that experiment. It's not a hard experiment. You can prove that you have exactly one NV in your system. Good. Now then, we still need to get to some control. All this is preparation. Yeah. Oh, thank you. So in the confocal microscopy, take the detector and then take that and run, take that fiber and run it to a mirror, to this half-silvered mirror. Okay? You want your detector to have one photon going. Let's come down. So if I want to test that I only have one photon, then I take away that detector and I put a half silvered mirror and I put two detectors. Assuming that there are two, remember, thanks for this. Assuming that there's two, right, then they'll be emitting randomly. And what we're measuring is an intensity. So we're always integrating over time, right? So the probability that, let's say that I have one emitter, one NV, and I look at the photons. You know, there'll be some random set of photons, right? And let's say I have, and if I take and I wrap this one to I send this one through this, then you can see that if I have delta T correct, there's only one photon that's given out. It has to go to one of those detectors. But if I have delta T misset, then there'll be some finite probability that although I have one detector from here, though I'll get another detector in the line, another photon in the line, and both detectors will go off. Okay, so if I have one single photon source, then I still need to adjust the timing of my two detectors to be just right so that I'm only sensitive to there being two photons at the same instant in time. And then, of course, if I have another center, there'll be some probability that two of them will be emitted at the same time, and of course there'll be some small probability that they actually get into the detector. But you know, we're measuring thousands of events in order to do this. Okay? Good. All right. So now then, let me just go over here because we're out of time. So what I'll do on Thursday is we'll talk about this structure. Now, these are still spins. And so we can write down the Hamiltonian in the spin one basis. And this separation is about 3 gigahertz. So with, you know, with NMR, we could excite and detect with your FM radio. Here, we need your microwave oven. But we can excite this. We can follow through and see this. And we're going to do all of our spin physics here with the laser off. Because if I go up into the excited state, then the Hamiltonian is going to change. So the electronic structure is going to lead to a different so-called zero field splitting in the excited state. And the lifetime in the excited state is random. So if I randomly sample a different Hamiltonian, then that will look like a dephasing of our system. So everything we're going to do is going to be in, for coherent control, is going to be here. And then we'll turn the laser on to see what we did. Okay? So we'll follow up on that on Thursday. And tomorrow we'll meet in the sky room. Okay, thanks.